From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! India is accusing Pakistan of complicity in the Indian Airlines hijacking. We'll go to New Delhi to speak with an anti-nuclear activist about what this could mean on tensions between the two nuclear nations. More on the resignation of Boris Yeltsin in Russia. And a conversation about the Y2K crisis that hasn't happened, at least yet. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Indian Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, today accused his arch foe, Pakistan, of being behind the hijacking of an Indian plane and urged that the Muslim nation be declared a terrorist state. Last Friday, India negotiated the release of 154 hostages who'd been held in a hijacked Indian Airlines plane for 8 days. India released 3 jailed Kashmiri militants in the deal it struck with the 5 hijackers. Meanwhile, a crude landmine exploded today in a market in Srinagar, the heart of Indian-ruled Kashmir, which killed at least 15 people. We'll have more on that story later in the show. Newsweek is reporting that Boris Yeltsin may be linked to Swiss bank accounts containing about $15 million, accounts which have been frozen by authorities investigating Russian money laundering. The criminal investigation may have been one of several reasons Yeltsin abruptly resigned as president of Russia on Friday. Yeltsin's hand-picked successor, Vladimir Putin, promised the outgoing leader and his family complete immunity from prosecution. Swiss authorities, which froze the accounts last summer, suspect they may be linked to former President Yeltsin, but refuse to say why. Swiss and Italian prosecutors are investigating an alleged multi-billion-dollar Russian money laundering scheme linked to Russian politicians, businessmen, and their family members. They also believe there are links between accounts in a Bank of New York money laundering case and the frozen Swiss accounts. The White House moved to distance itself from a business deal involving the First Lady's brothers in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, not wishing to be linked to a hazelnut venture championed by a Georgian opposition leader. The Clinton administration has let the Georgian government know that the deal is not supported by the U.S. government. The father of Elian Gonzalez gets a visit today in Cuba from the outgoing head of the National Council of Churches. The Reverend Joan Campbell has flown there to help Juan Miguel Gonzalez get his son back. 6-year-old Elian has been the subject of a political tug-of-war since surviving a disastrous boat trip to Florida. Campbell says the National Council of Churches thinks the boy should have been returned by now. She says they're puzzled why it's taking so long. Elian was found lashed to an inner tube Thanksgiving Day. The Immigration and Naturalization Service has a hearing on Elian scheduled January 21st. It had been scheduled before Christmas, but was postponed. The council is the largest ecumenical organization in the United States, representing 35 Protestant and Orthodox denominations. Israeli President Ehud Barak is scheduled to meet in Shepherdstown, West Virginia today in U.S. brokered talks with Farouk al-Sharaa, Syria's foreign minister. This will be the second round of peace talks between Israel and Syria in a month. Syria refuses to hammer out a peace deal without the return of the Golan Heights. This news from Dili. East Timor independence leader José Ramos Horta called today for an inquiry into a 1991 massacre in Dili, saying he had been given a map pinpointing 2 mass graves that could contain more than 100 bodies. Numerous witness accounts support the claim that scores of bodies were dumped in the graves, and a map sketched by independence fighter Shinano Gushmao indicates the precise location, he said. On November 12, 1991, Indonesian troops opened fire on thousands of people gathered at the Santa Cruz Cemetery, killing at least 250. Chinese courts have sentenced to prison two dissidents who took part in an outlawed Democratic Party and a doctor who demonstrated against the banning of the Falun Gong spiritual movement. This, according to a rights group today, an assistant physics professor at Hunan University and a factory worker and labor organizer in the Hunan provincial capital of Changsha were put on trial for subversion on November 30th, said the Hong Kong-based Information Center of Human Rights and Democratic Movement in China. Barred from attending the trial at Changsha's Intermediate People's Court, family members today received their first notice of the verdict. Guilty as charged, with one man sentenced to 10 years in prison and another to 6 years. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Let's see how the Wall Street Journal put it today. Two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters who have followed Yeltsin's entire term have a piece called Life with Boris, Rousing, Infuriating, Always Surprising Yeltsin the Singular. It's by Andrew Higgins and Steve Leisman. It says, it makes your neck hurt. Boris Yeltsin gave up tennis years ago, but watching him rule Russia for the better part of a decade has left the world with a case of whiplash worthy of Wimbledon. Swinging back and forth on political and economic reform, Mr. Yeltsin created a blur of late-night government sackings, capricious presidential decrees, impulsive policy reversals, and then siren-screeching cavalcades to and from the hospital. The score sheet is staggering. 7 prime ministers, 6 national elections, a quintuple heart bypass operation, 4 loan agreements with the International Monetary Fund, 3 ruble crises, 2 vicious wars in Chechnya, and a stunning grand finale, a Millennium Eve resignation. Well, we're joined right now by Professor Peter Gowan. He's professor of international studies at the University of North London. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Professor Gowan.
Good morning.
Can you first respond to the surprise New Year's Eve resignation of Boris Yeltsin?
Well, I think that the resignation can be explained partly by the fact that Yeltsin was already faced with the task of leaving office later on this year. And he felt that if he could leave office with a guarantee that he would be immune from prosecution on the part of his successor, this would obviously preserve his family and their entourage from the possibility of criminal trials for corruption. So that was one motive for Yeltsin to hand over to his Prime Minister Putin on the understanding that he would get immunity from prosecution. I think the second factor is, of course, the fact that Yeltsin has been a deeply unpopular figure in Russian politics, and his unpopularity has only been increasing. And therefore, this way of bowing out, a bowing out that took everybody by surprise, was obviously a good way for him to ease himself out of the political scene.
Can you explain who the new president for now is until elections, supposedly in March, Putin?
Yes, well, Putin came up through the Soviet KGB, the Soviet Security and Intelligence Organization, in the 80s. He then proved himself in Russia's second city, Petersburg, as an able administrator, still connected to the intelligence services, but working for the Petersburg administration. He was then picked up by the power elite in Moscow, I think by Anatoly Chubais, the very important advisor to Yeltsin, who had been in charge of a thoroughly corrupt privatization process during the 1980s and had then masterminded Yeltsin's 1996 re-election campaign. And Chubais brought Putin to Moscow, where he eventually became the leader of the Russian security service. And I think that what that demonstrated was the fact that for the Yeltsin family, Putin was loyal and reliable, was not going to rock the boat, and might even protect them and their interests from public prosecutors and so on. Secondly, he's obviously a very efficient operator within the Russian state, with good contacts in the security services. But I think thirdly, at the time when Putin became prime minister, it was very important for the Yeltsin group to appease the military security apparatus of the Russian state, which felt humiliated over the Kosovo War. And Putin's coming into office to launch the war in Chechnya was an important way of giving the military security elites in Moscow their head. And so all these factors, I think, are important in Putin's rise.
Professor Gowan, it can't be very promising for the Chechens that Putin has been elevated in this way. One of his first acts outside of pardoning Boris Yeltsin and his family was heading to Chechnya and decorating Russian troops by giving them knives.
Yes, I mean, it's absolutely vital for Putin that he wins in Chechnya, and he will take every possible measure to ensure that this happens, whatever the cost. And therefore, we can expect, now that he is president, that his chief priority right now must be to take Grozny and to give an impression of full Russian control over Chechnya.
And what about this news report that's coming out of Newsweek? I read the headline at the top of the show about Boris Yeltsin's link to Swiss bank accounts containing some $15 million, may also be linked to a Bank of New York money laundering cases as well. Does this surprise you?
No, it's not in the least surprising. We've known for a long time that the Yeltsin family has stashed away large amounts of money, probably a good deal more than $15 million, abroad. And Yeltsin's daughters, one in particular, is known to be at the center of a whole corrupt network. So although the information about these bank accounts is new, it's something that people have long taken for granted.
We're also getting news that authorities in Lebanon now say that one police officer was killed in a rocket-propelled grenade attack on the Russian embassy in Beirut. They say one of the attackers was shot and killed by police. We don't have much more on that. What do you know about this?
I know nothing about the actual event itself, but one can expect that there are a large number of Islamic groups, not only in the Caucasus, but in the Middle East and so on, who are now very strongly focused on taking revenge for the Russian campaign in Chechnya.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and we'll continue to follow developments in Russia as well as Chechnya. Finally, you mentioned Kosovo. Putin, how would he have dealt differently with Kosovo? There was, there was Russian resistance to the NATO bombing, but many in Russia obviously weren't happy with it not being stronger.
Yes, well, one doesn't know what Putin's own personal line was during the Kosovo conflict, but as far as the Russian military leadership was concerned, they would have liked the Russian government to have threatened retaliatory military action, or at least retaliatory military support for the Serbs during that war. One form of such support would have been more effective anti-aircraft defences. Secondly, the Russian military took the view at the end of the conflict that Russia could have and should have insisted on taking control of the northern part of Kosovo, leading perhaps to the division of Kosovo, and the Yeltsin government did not, in fact, in the end, push for that. And so there was a general feeling at the end of the Kosovo War that the Yeltsin government had failed in what was seen as its duty to support Serbia in that conflict, and had sold out to the West.
Well, Professor Gowen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor Peter Gowen teaches international politics at the University of North London. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move quickly to one of the other lead stories in the news, and that's taking place in India and Pakistan. Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee today accusing his arch foe Pakistan of being behind the hijacking of the Indian plane that grabbed some headlines in the last few days, and urged that Pakistan be declared a terrorist state. Last Friday, India negotiated the release of 154 hostages who'd been held in the hijacked Indian Airlines plane for 8 days. India released 3 jailed Kashmiri militants in the deal it struck with the 5 hijackers. Meanwhile, a crude landmine has exploded today in a market in Srinagar, the heart of Indian-ruled Kashmir. It killed 15 people, wounded 25. No group has claimed responsibility for the blast. India and Pakistan locked in a bitter dispute over the northern Himalayan region of Kashmir. We go right now to New Delhi to speak with Achin Vinayak, who is a co-author of a book called New Nukes that will be released in the United States very soon. He's an anti-nuclear and human rights activist and political commentator in New Delhi. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Achin. Can you first give us the latest information, if people were a little distracted by the New Year's celebrations, about what was the conclusion of the Indian Airlines hijacking?
Well, basically, the release of the 154 passengers was took place in return for the release of 3 militants who were under in Indian prisons. All 3 of them are connected to Kashmiri insurgent groups. One of them, in fact, is a British national.
Was the leader...
Kashmiri origin, but a British national.
Was the leader released who had been named as the person they originally hijacked the plane for?
Yes. In fact, the 3 people do not belong to the same groups in Kashmir. But the principal person whose release was demanded belongs to an organization which incidentally has claimed that it is not responsible for the hijacking. But that may or may not mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the significance of this hijacking? Now, the men, the hijackers, were in, the plane was in Afghanistan?
Yes, it flew from Kathmandu, Nepal. Mm-hmm. And the hijacking took place when it flew from Nepal. It landed in another part of India called Amritsar. It was denied landing in Lahore, Pakistan, and then ended up in Kandahar in Afghanistan. Uh-huh. Clearly, the Indian government bungled greatly when it did not prevent, although it had a second chance, when it did not prevent the plane from flying away from Indian territory at Amritsar.
But in Kandahar, the militants were released and the hijackers were then allowed to leave the plane and just went into Afghanistan?
Yes, the Indian government brought the three people whose release was demanded. they were handed over to the Taliban authorities, who in turn handed them over to the hijackers, and the hijackers were given 10 hours to leave Afghanistan. They also took with them one soldier, Taliban soldier, as hostage, who was subsequently released and has gone back.
Well,
and,
when we come back from our break, we'll find out what happened next and what this means for India-Pakistan relations, with India now blaming Pakistan, saying it's behind the hijacking, what this means for these two nuclear nations. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll continue with Achin Vinayak when we come back. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Achin Vinayak, he is co-author of the book New Nukes, which will be published soon in the United States. He is an anti-nuclear and human rights activist in New Delhi, India, talking about the Indian Airlines hijacking that took place, resolved several days ago, where three militants were released in exchange for the release of the 154 hostages that at that point were in the plane in Afghanistan. The hijackers were allowed to leave through Afghanistan. And right now, the Indian government is saying that Pakistan took them in and is actually behind the hijacking. Achin Vinayak, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it is one thing to claim that the hijackers have been operating from Pakistan territory or from that part of Kashmir, which Pakistan controls. It's another thing to suggest or to imply that there is a direct link in the sense that the Pakistan government is behind the hijacking. That's a much more serious charge, and it's not a charge that should be made irresponsibly. And it's not clear from what the Indians are saying if they're simply trying to suggest that because they're operating from they've come from Pakistan territory, therefore the Pakistanis, by allowing them to exist on their territory, are somehow responsible. I mean, that's a different charge altogether from a claim that, you know, the Pakistan government is behind it.
And what do you think is behind the Indian government saying this?
Well, I think number one, of course, is that they want to deflect attention away from their own bungling, because they have their failure to do anything about preventing the plane from leaving and therefore keep a control of the situation when it was on Indian territory is a stark failure. The second thing, of course, is that there has been a substantial amount of criticism for them to having given in to the hijackers' demands. And so it is also partly convenient. Now, for the moment, there is not sufficient evidence to indicate that the Pakistan government is behind something, and it may not. No such evidence may turn out. But the fact that they have operated or they've come from Pakistan, well, that's another thing. And that's part of the general parcel of trading of charges between the two countries, the sort of growing tensions between the two countries ever since the Kargil dispute, in which you had a combination of Pakistan regular soldiers and some insurgents coming into the Indian part of Kashmir, and led to a conflict that was stopped earlier this year.
Can you give us some context to the demands of the hijackers? Can you explain now what is happening in Kashmir and what the original struggle is in Kashmir?
What's happened in Kashmir is that Kashmir has been a disputed territory between India and Pakistan ever since the independence of these two countries. This has to do with the peculiarities with which the ending of colonialism took place, or British rule took place. Basically, there were certain parts of South Asia which were ruled indirectly by the British. That is to say that they were ruled by local kings or princes who were subordinate to British rule. So that when the time for independence came of India and Pakistan, these rulers were given the choice of aligning themselves either with India or Pakistan. Kashmir was ruled by a Hindu king with a majority Muslim population, which was undecided which way to go. And in 1947, the Pakistanis, because they said it was a Muslim-majority province and should come to them, impatiently sent its troops across. The Hindu king asked for help, and the Indian government at the time said that we can only help you if you formally accede to India, which he did. And then that incursion by Pakistani troops was contained. UN ceasefire line took place, and the country has been divided along the that part of the world has been divided along the ceasefire line ever since, and with both countries claiming proper jurisdiction over the two countries. So it's been going on like this for ever since the birth of two countries in 47. In the early 80s, there emerged for the first time in the Indian controlled part of Kashmir insurgency movements of an Islamic nature, which were fighting either for an independent Islamic Kashmir or for unity with Pakistan. And these insurgent groups are related to that development since the early 80s.
The latest news, this landmine that exploded today in Srinagar, which is in the heart of Kashmir, that killed at least 15 people. Any later news on that?
There's not much more than what you said, but these are things that have been happening periodically ever since the worsening and deterioration of the situation from the 80s onwards. The tragedy in many ways of the Kashmir situation is that both the Indian and Pakistani governments insist that this is that they have the rights or they have control over Kashmir. But the voices of the Kashmiri people on both sides of the border is not given due. And is not sufficiently heard as to what they themselves think about their fate and their future.
Finally, what does this mean for the nuclear future of the two countries, India and Pakistan, which is really what you have been focusing on as an anti-nuclear activist? Do you see this as a very serious escalation of tensions?
Well, what has certainly happened is that there has been a serious deterioration of relations ever since both countries went nuclear, first with Kargil and then with this hijacking. And this symbolizes one of the very serious, in fact, among the most serious things that has happened, and that is that this part of the world is now the place in which matters can get out of control between two countries, each of which is nuclearly equipped. And Kashmir is a potential nuclear flashpoint. And this is a point of extreme worry. I'm not saying that this hijack could have led to that, but it is highlighted in a very dramatic way, this reality. And this reality is extremely disturbing. And it calls for a serious response, both regionally and internationally, for us to move towards global nuclear disarmament.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Achin Vinayak, for being with us, co-author of the book New Nukes, which is just being published in the United States, anti-nuclear activist and human rights activist in New Delhi, India, also a political commentator. We thank you for joining us on Democracy Now! And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to another story that certainly has dominated the headlines here, and it is the issue of the Y2K crisis that didn't happen. The government might call it, this is what prevention looks like. Others might say it was a lot of hype to pay lawyers and computer consultants to take over in the last few days. Well, the first major business day since the year 2000 rollover is unfolding with very few signs of Y2K glitches. Europeans return to work today to find energy supplies and computer systems operating smoothly. Finland, Denmark, Sweden, and Poland so far not reporting Y2K problems. Swiss banks have experienced no signs of abnormalities after booting up their computers. But the Y2K bug did infest a computer at Oak Ridge National Laboratory's Y-12 nuclear weapons plant in Tennessee. But Energy Department officials say it didn't affect operations or workers. The exact nature of the malfunction wasn't revealed because the computer controls a classified function. The plant manufactures warheads components for the MX missile system and is the primary uranium storage site for the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Elsewhere here in the U.S., there could be headaches looming for schools and small businesses that didn't make preparations for the changeover. In October, the government said over one-third of all public school districts were not ready for computer glitches that affect heating, food service, and teacher payrolls. Well, we're joined right now by two people who are experts in the issue of computer technology. Jim Dempsey is Senior Staff Counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology, and Jamie Love is with the Consumer Project on Technology. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to be with you both. Jim Dempsey, let's start with you. Were you surprised by the lack of problems?
Well, I took a sort of an agnostic approach to it. It was clear that people were spending an awful lot of money and effort to prepare. Personally, I have to say I bought some extra water, but I forgot to fill up the car with gas and didn't buy any extra food. So there you are. I treated it as something that might cause some small disruption, but I really didn't think that the cascading kinds of problems that were predicted by some were all that likely. It is true, people spent a lot of time fixing it. I think in retrospect, there was undoubtedly a fair amount of hype, but I think you have to say that it was a real problem that required attention. The fact that we can't tell exactly what was the percentage of hype now, even in retrospect, and what was the percentage of reality, that's something worth talking about and thinking about in terms of do any of us really understand as consumers, as private citizens, even people who are somewhat technologically sophisticated, you do have a hard time telling the hype from the reality.
Mm-hmm. Jamie Love, this certainly has been an excuse for some legislation, for example, protecting corporations from liability that may have extended beyond Y2K liability. It's been a real boon for lawyers around the issues of liabilities and for computer experts. I mean, my God, they were working around the clock in the last weeks. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that the idea that you might get sued if there was a problem was probably stimulated some of the efforts to fix the problem before it happened. I think that the lot of publicity that it was associated with the year 2K problem was constructive in the sense that people, even small businesses, I think, spent a lot of time looking at their systems. I know in our case, we have our own system at work and a fairly small organization, but we identified even in the month of December some programs that we had to switch in terms of our internet server software that wouldn't have worked properly after January. And like a lot of people, in the process of fixing problems associated with the year 2K problem, we ended up upgrading our software and ended up with probably better software. So it forced people to spend a lot of attention on their infrastructure, and probably had a one effect was probably people end up upgrading and improving some of their computer infrastructure in that period. I think that the it was a mistake for the Congress to pass legislation to take people off the hook relative to problems that might have associated with the year 2K thing. The point of the tort system isn't as much. It's only partly to reward people who are damaged, but it's also to give people the correct economic incentives not to damage people. So I think that big organizations probably spent some time trying to get on top of the problem. I also think the United States has more computers deployed than most other countries do. If you travel abroad, it's pretty clear that the extent of use of computers is
way above average in the United States. So I think it's probably also true that we were more likely to see more problems in this country than elsewhere. Also, I think there will be a lot of glitches that will emerge over the next week or so that were not obvious just yet.
And what do you think those will be? I mean, that is being mentioned and was even before New Year's, and that was that maybe these crises wouldn't come right at the turn of the year of 2000, but in these weeks and months to come.
Well, suppose, for example, you have devices that require periodic maintenance, or I'll just give you a small example. I mean, not that I'm aware of any year 2K problems, but Coke machines dial in to tell people when they're empty and they need to be refilled, or elevators may need maintenance, or there's a variety of things like that. Many of these things depend upon computer technology, some of it embedded in the hardware, hard to check. And so you might have problems with maintenance. You may have problems.
Coke machines dial in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the modern technology in the United States is if you observe machines, you know, that sell Coca-Cola on the street, a lot of them are designed so that they will call in when they're empty. I'm not saying that this is necessarily going to be a failure year 2K thing, but I mean it shows how I think computers have now become part of all sorts of things that we do, not just the thing on your desktop that browses the web, but microwave ovens, elevators, Coke machines, all sorts of things. Your car itself all runs on microchips. And to the degree that some of these things had periodic maintenance programs built in or things like that, you might expect problems. There was a problem, for example, in Japan of a monitoring system failing in a nuclear power plant there temporarily because some clock had been set wrong. And it just wasn't working properly.
I wanted to go beyond talking about the glitch and talk about the issue we face in this year and coming years, and that is also the challenge to our privacy, and also hit on the issue of bots, our bots. I don't know if you got to see the New York Times on Saturday, but it was quite unbelievable. A full-page mock New York Times for the year 2100. And one of the lead stories was, "Are bots demanding equality snarl brainweb?" And I just wanted to read a little from it. It says, "In an effort to freeze information transmissions worldwide, thousands of R-bots last night simultaneously interrupted the universal global network. The deluge of disruptions brought the net to within moments of collapsing, net supervisors confirmed minutes ago. The orchestrated campaign in the waning hours of 2099 was to protest the United States Supreme Court's refusal to remove what R-bot rights proponents characterize as the remaining legal obstacles to R-bots living a normal life. The campaign had won growing support among R-bots since last October, when a deadlock court proved unable to decide whether the union of an R-bot and a human being constitutes marriage. Consolidated Monitoring said this morning that the network's capacity to generate new nodes had averted a freeze of the web that connects human beings to one another and to all other electronic exchanges. In the Supreme Court's deadlock last fall, four of its eight human justices voted to sustain a lower court's refusal to hear the case. Three other justices sided with the court's lone justice bot. In September, Chief Justice Laura Hand threw the court into disarray when she belatedly acknowledged an inappropriate relationship with an R-bot years earlier and recused herself from the case. And then it says 3 years ago, the Federal Appeals Court for Intermodal Activities had ruled that marriage was legally precluded under the Supreme Court's loving and nurturing doctrine of 30 years standing. In its landmark 2067 decision, a unanimous court had ruled that activities involving those qualities were reserved for human beings. And then the New York Times goes on in its January 1st, 2100 edition to say, "The 2067 decision, in a case brought by an edubot, barred R-bots from taking charge of a classroom. That ruling said children are different from system upgrades. It was soon invoked to preclude homebots from childcare and later to bar meatybots from the hands-on practice of medicine." And it goes on from there. Is this so far-fetched?
Well, it raises this question and a fear, which is, do we control this technology or does the technology control us? I think the lesson in the Y2K issue and the response to it is that, in fact, we can control the technology. I think that's important for issues like privacy, which you mentioned. There are those out there saying you've lost your privacy, the privacy is dead, get over it. And that sort of expresses this feeling that we don't create this, but we do. We create this technology every day. We design it. We can control it. We can design it the way we want it. And we can design it for privacy, or we can ignore the privacy implications, or we can design it in ways that enhance surveillance and monitoring capabilities, both of governments and corporations.
Jim Dempsey, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we'll come back to you as with the Center for Democracy and Technology and Jamie Love with the Consumer Project on Technology in just a minute. After that, we're going to find out just who Steve Roach, Glenn McGinnis, Anzell Jones, Toronto Patterson, and Douglas Christopher Thomas are. Stay with us. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and yes, we are in the year 2000 as we talk about the issue of computers, computer glitches, and maybe the greatest challenge in this century, and that is the issue of privacy. We're joined by Jamie Love of the Consumer Project on Technology and Jim Dempsey with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Jim Dempsey, you're talking about privacy, and you believe there are ways to protect ourselves.
Well, I think that the Y2K crisis and the apparent resolution of it shows that on one hand, we have allowed technology to develop in ways that people don't fully understand. And even in retrospect now, people are not entirely sure how much of the Y2K crisis was hype and how much was reality. I think there was, obviously, from my perspective, a mixture of both. But as we look forward now, we should take the lessons. I think we need, as Jamie pointed out, more and more of our lives are becoming dependent upon these computer systems. I think that places increased importance upon openness. One of the important movements, I think, in the computer field is the open source movement, which says that many types of important computer programs need not be proprietary, but that they can be open to the public, and anybody can look at them and identify problems and flaws. And also the whole concept of user control. Here we have a technology which in many respects is inherently user controlled. Individuals could, assuming we design the systems that way, individuals could exercise greater control over the technology. Certainly, individuals can exercise more control over this than they can over television or broadcast, if you look at traditional media. And I think going forward, these need to be our watchwords and our goals to ensure that the technology is open, user-controlled, that the decentralized nature of this medium is recognized and protected.
But it seems that we really are going in the other direction. I mean, while you talk theoretically about how we can protect ourselves, at this point you're having to give over credit cards on the phone, over a computer. People don't realize where that information is going.
Well, that's true. And I think the ultimate policy solution is going to be a mix of technology, market pressures brought upon companies to be more respectful of privacy, and legislation and regulatory controls to protect privacy. We're not there yet. We're not close to there. A number of companies, though, being careless of the privacy of their customers, have gotten themselves into public relations and marketing nightmares of their own making, and have had to revamp their practices in order to be more sensitive to privacy. So I think that is going to be an important way in which consumers push and sort of vote with their dollars for privacy. It's how it's ultimately going to end up is still up for grabs, but I think that we need to recognize the potential of consumer demand. We need to recognize the potential of the technology. We need to look at some of the traditional and not so traditional regulatory and governmental models. We are a society of lawyers in some respect, so we will look to that as well to solve this problem. Well,
Jamie Love, let me give you the last word and ask. I mean, it seems that we're dealing with two huge problems. One is we've got some of the greatest monopolists on one side, like Microsoft. And on the other side, you've got computer users who are very much isolated from each other. It doesn't seem on either side to make for any kind of big movement.
Well, yeah, I'd have to put a bigger emphasis on the area of government regulation here. I think that that the New York Times story you referred to ran over the weekend that predicted the future had another story, and that was how the Congress had eventually decided the United States government started auctioning off the congressional seats formally, and that was meant as kind of a bit of a spoof, but it explains, I think, why we don't have effective privacy regulation. We're in a real period of privacy meltdown. We have the current range of technologies, which are unbelievable in terms of tracking in very granular fashion what people see, what people buy, what people do on the Internet, in ways almost to the degree you could track the pages of a book that you look through, or the photographs you scan with your eyes. And so it's very frightening that on the one hand, and then you have a complete lack of action by the Congress in the privacy front, and that's because they're all chasing cyber campaign contributions. I mean, the members of Congress are corrupted by the campaign finance system, so they ignore the demands there are from the public for effective regulation of privacy, which is the only thing that will really make a difference, is if you regulate the buying and selling of personal data. Then you have to look down the future at the next generation of privacy invading technologies, cameras that can be worn on your clothing and can pick up things, or placed on the walls of buildings or things like that. You'll have the equivalent of truth detectors, or things that can monitor your emotions. There's a whole next generation of things that are going to be very invasive in terms of personal privacy. And unless you put realistic efforts by governments to start regulating the buying and selling of that kind of privacy invasive information, you're going to have real huge problems.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, and want to give you a chance to give out your websites for people to follow the latest on movements to protect privacy. Jamie Love with the Consumer Project on Technology.
Yeah, I'm at cptech.org, www.cptech.org.
And Jim Dempsey.
Yes, we're at www.cdt, Center for Democracy and Technology, cdt.org.
Well, thank you, and Happy New Year. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Douglas Christopher Thomas, Steve Roach, Glenn McGinnis, and Zell Jones in Toronto Patterson. Five men who, when they were each 17 years old, committed a very serious crime. They murdered someone. In the next 2 months, they all are set to be executed. It'll mark the first time since the death penalty was reinstated in the United States that so many juvenile offenders would be executed in so short a period of time. Well, just last month, the National Mental Health Association voted to oppose the executions of these five people who committed their offenses under the age of 18. And we're joined right now by Michael Faenza, who is CEO and president of the National Mental Health Association. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us about this move by the NMHA to try to stop these executions? And what chance do you think you have? The executions will be performed in Texas and Virginia. The first, Douglas Christopher Thomas, on January 10th.
Yes. Well, the fact that we in this country at this time in our history are going to start the millennium by putting five people to death that committed crimes when they were kids is it's just an unbelievable thing to our organization. And in fact, there has been an outcry, virtually a consensus against the execution of people who are children at the time of their crime at an international level. In terms of will we have an impact, well, will the sentences of these young people be commuted? I do not know. We're up against a huge public relations battle, sadly, because of politicization of punishing children in this country. There's only been five nations that have executed juveniles in the last decade, and five other nations, and those are Iran and Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. The use of the death penalty, it's important to note, against juvenile offenders is actually directly prohibited by several international treaties to which the United States signed on. And those include the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the American Convention on Human Rights. I was actually thinking, as I was listening to your terrific program, about the advances in technology and the huge implications of technology, its impact on privacy and just the life of Americans and people all over the world, that even though we are there with technology, some of the most basic issues facing human beings to us seem to be stuck in an era of barbaric social action. I think the fact that this country would go against these international treaties, that we have federal and state policy that allows people who were minors to be executed, really is a caricature of how little progress we have made, where I think arguably it counts the most. And when we look at what is happening in terms of punishment of young people and how our justice system is operating, you know, we need to realize that the context for these kind of actions is that there are almost 2 million people locked up in this country. The tie to mental health and mental illness for our organization is that at a number of levels, kids and adults with mental illnesses are increasingly lacking availability to treatment and being caught in justice systems. And as terrible as the crimes were of these five young men who were actually be considered children at the time of their offenses, all of them had a history of abuse and very serious mental health problems that weren't treated adequately, and these situations should be taken into account when there is a sentencing for such a terrible crime. And it's just unconscionable that these five young people are being put to death in this day and age in the United States.
Michael Faenza, president of the National Mental Health Association. Now, your group has sent letters to Texas Governor George W. Bush and to the Virginia Governor James Gilmore. Have you gotten a response?
At this hour, we still have not.
The first execution is scheduled for January 10th, Douglas Christopher Thomas. He is one of two white men. He's 26. The others are 23, 26, 21, and 21. The other three are African-American in Texas. The two in Virginia are white. I think that really also shows pretty much the breakdown on death row, the disproportionate number of people of color on death row. But January 10th is coming up in Virginia. What are your plans?
Well, what we are doing is working with our 350 affiliates across the country. There are mental health associations in counties and state capitals across this country, and our folks have been urged also to write Governors Gilmore and Bush, and also we're making our position known to media in those states. So there's folks that are writing letters and making phone calls to the Houston Chronicle and the Dallas Morning News and the media in Virginia also.
Yeah, you mentioned that there are international treaties against this, like that the United States is a signatory to, like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the American Convention on Human Rights. But do these conventions really have any effect on U.S. government practices?
Well, they certainly do in areas where the federal government and the political climate support the substance of the agreement. What we have done in the United States over the last few years, and it really started with the reinstatement of the death penalty in 1976, was to create federal legislation and state legislation that has made it increasingly probable for young people to be put to death, for young people who have committed crimes, including crimes that do not involve taking the lives of other people, to be treated as adults in the criminal justice system. So if we had not had this kind of political and legislative movement in the United States, I'm sure there would be an outcry if other countries, Western countries, were implementing this practice. But we seem to be turning our head in Washington and in the state capitals.
Do you have any political strategy you plan for this year? It is the presidential election year. All of the major candidates of the Democratic and Republican Party support the death penalty. What are you going to do about that? We have 10 seconds.
We are not going to take on the death penalty, but we are certainly going to take on the criminalization of mental illness in kids and adults and call for reform. And what we're seeing with the death of these five kids pending is just a caricature of the wrong direction we're moving.
If people want to get a hold of information from the National Mental Health Association, where can they call or go on the web?
They can, I'll give you that right now. They can call the National Mental Health Association at 703-838-7500.
And also, I see your website is www.nmha, National Mental Health Association.org. Well, I want to thank you very much, Michael Faenza, for being with us. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Karen Palmer, and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Happy New Year.